top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 378 of the Really Awful Movies podcast. Hellbender. Hellbender. So in literary convention, you have the Bildungsroman, which is, examples of which can include David Copperfield, Throw in Your Jane Eyre. You could even throw in To Kill a Mockingbird. It's like the coming of age tale is something that you don't necessarily associate with the horror movie space. And to its credit, that's something Hellbender actually does. In fact, kids with any sort of moral or ethical agency would be rare enough of a bird in horror itself that you can't help but grant kudos and a little nod to the makers of Hellbender, which is actually, as it's been widely noted, a family affair, the family Addams. Two of whom I believe star in this movie, but they are responsible for making this as a mini collective effort. I think each having a hand in directing different segments, which may, I think, have contributed to the overall kind of episodic feel this one has, despite having a short runtime. But you have this movie that is just widely and wildly hyped. Everyone from The Guardian to The New York Times to a guy I quite like down in Ohio named Chris Stuckman, who was praising this one. And you can't help but going into it when something has a 97% Rotten Tomatoes ranking, then the imprimatur of this aggregator god of criticism, you can't help but be a reactionary to it in some ways. It's just human nature to push back. And to the extent I'm going to do so is going to reflect just, it's going to reflect, I think, some of my biases in horror, but also I hope bring to bear some of the love I have for the indie space. And this is what's called a micro-budget horror. So it looks like they probably spend about $50,000 on it. That's a little unfair. Let's say they probably spent $50,000 on it. I don't want to disparage it by saying it looks like they spent $50,000 on it, but this is one that is a very small movie that, despite its size, really punches above its weight in terms of stature, because it has a lot of amazing, amazing visuals that can really carry the day. As we saw with Malatesta's Carnival of Horror, if you have enough visually compelling elements, it can really prop a film up in a way that, not necessarily having the most engaging plot, it can counteract and provide a counterbalance for something that is maybe not the most plot heavy. I posted something on Instagram saying that if you're going to have a movie that's largely plotless, I mean, that's being a little unkind, but you better at least have something that is nonstop action, or nonstop something that's compelling and at least scintillating and engaging enough to really drive interest. This is an 80-minute movie, and I felt that at times it didn't quite engage me to the extent that maybe should. And that's by no means a discredit to the talent behind the camera, because this is, I mean, really driven by Zelda Adams, just a terrific young actress, and everything about her is kind of flattened, and then she comes out of her shell. So what I mean is, like, sure, her hair is flat, her chest is flat, her posture is kind of flat. She doesn't, she goes through the world lacking, bravado and confidence. And this speaks to the fact that, or at least to the perceptions that come with being homeschooled. And so she's shrouded and kept apart from the rest of humanity. And this looks to me like it's somewhere in the Pacific Northwest. You have these really lush forests, and you almost have this nymph-like quality to this character who is basically sequestered in the forest. It almost has like a Grimm's fairy tale kind of vibe to it, but she's under the thumb in many, many respects of her rather witchly mother. And her mother is played by her mother, Toby Posner, and she has like an almost Andy McDowell kind of wild mane and just a wild array of curls that can't help but look witchly on a woman of a certain vintage, let's be honest, right? She's got this thick, really curly, really crazy hair, and she's just an amazing character as well. And the two of them have powers, and they have these unearthly powers. And the the daughter has a X-linked chromosomal autoimmune disorder that she gets from her mother, and the unveiling and the revealing of what's behind that is in part what drives Hellbender. Now, this is a movie that really is very, very small and very quiet and very quirky. And there are, for lack of a better term, artistic overhead shots of, you know, we have the Zelda Adams character, the girl, I believe her name is Izzy in the film, but you have her swimming in the river, and then the overhead shot, and then it's superimposed with like a bridge or a road, and there's lots of gazing into space. There's lots of ethereal kind of chimerical visual aesthetics brought to this, and lots of spacey visuals, and lots of decent practical effects with a sparingly used CG, so very, very sparingly. And in the opening scene, you have a witch being hung, and you are brought into this world that is, again, very cloistered and very small and very contained. And insofar as atmosphere makes horror, Hellbender is one that is just has it in spades, let's just say. And what you have is this duo, and they are so sheltered from the rest of the world that even their hobbies are just totally removed from engaging with anyone beyond their little realm. And they again live out in the woods a la Grimm fairy tales, and a la the Brothers Grimm. And they have this little kind of indie band of a bass and drums, and they play like kind of a spacey and, I gotta say, at times really well done music. And it's pretty funny when you hear music happening in horror, and to the extent that it's good, I'm thinking I think it's the band in Driller Killer with who was it, Mel Farrar in that movie, I think. Well, there's a pretty decent punk band, and you have there's an authenticity that comes from performance in a music that in a movie that's actually really, really well done. And the musical performances here is, I mean, it undergirds the proceedings, and it's quite a weird little touch. And you could say that to some extent it does pad the running time, but it adds a definite intrigue, oral intrigue, to this film. And it's almost like a White Stripes duo of this kind of simple but yet very affecting musical accompaniment. However, again, this is very artsy, and this is very, very indie cinema and all the trappings that come with that. So in one scene, it goes on for 2 to 3 to 4 minutes, where you have a musical accompaniment to toy vehicles being driven toward one another, and something in the chorus about, I want to get in my car and drive. It goes on for quite a while, and to the extent that this one is not particularly structured in a conventional narrative sense, there's that's, you know, maybe a kinder way of saying not much happens. And when you have this kind of thing, I'm a little bit reminded of a similar film that has oodles of visual appeal and yet not much in the way of plotting, and that was something called Saint Maud. Another film that's just wildly hyped and just just over the top heaps of approbation on it, and it just made me wonder what it underscored again the gulf, the widening gulf you often see between critics and the general John Q public. In this one, I think it's the widest divide for Hellbender that I think I've ever seen, with reviews of 50 audience reviews and 97 almost near unanimity on the Rotten Tomatoes side of things. And it really does make you wonder, because I'm not want to do this often, but I was just digging through a few reviews here and there, and one of them, I forget the source, referred to this as a feminist parable. And just because your protagonists happen to be women, I just didn't understand how that comment was particularly warranted. A parable about what? Like, it just seemed to me word salad and word vomit a little bit. And there was some other writer and critic ruminating on the differences between men and women coming of age and maturity. And it just, I was lost on how that related to the movie. Maybe I'm just, you frequently wonder whether critics are merely projecting and whether they're just reading into things of which there is nothing to read into. I mean, there's not loads of subtext that I can particularly see in this film, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, not every horror movie has to be Invasion of the Body Snatchers or some overarching symbolism regarding the deteriorating state of the manufacturing economy, as in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, as people have alluded to. Not everything has to be something, and not everything has to be anything. And the people's ruminations on this one, it really makes you wonder. And to the extent that you can't help really judge a film based on anything other than what you engage with it, ideally that's what you should do. But having read all this about the unique status of how this one got made, when you have a family affair behind the lens, I can't think of anything comparable other than like the high profile examples of the brothers Wachowski, but or the Coen brothers or something. But you know, siblings is, that's different. It's just there's a two-headed snake or the two-headed monster, or whatever you want to call it, of directing generally doesn't work out too well, at least in horror. But this, I believe, is three, if not four, directors at the helm, and to the extent they were able to make a cohesive film is, I think, pretty remarkable. And this is definitely their CV writ large. I mean, there's a lot of talent going on here, and it's impossible to just cavalierly dismiss. However, again, depending on one's patience for long, protracted gazing off into space, one of the facets of European cinema that I think Family Guy poked fun at when one of the characters said, "Dear people of France," into a megaphone, "someone smoking a cigarette does not a movie make," or something to that effect. And it's a cliche for a reason that art house cinema and European cinema features prolonged, protracted absences of talk and absent any sort of dialogue. And that's not the case here. I mean, this movie is by no means Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf or anything like that, but it's quiet in parts and it's talky where it needs to be. And again, the dynamic between the mother and daughter is fabulous, and I'm sure their personal dynamic is great too, because you couldn't possibly work together like this if it were not. I was thinking of another mother-daughter program that I watched, speaking of Andy McDowell. It was called A Maid, and that also features Andy McDowell and her daughter, her real-life daughter, in the film. And it brings a certain, I mean, it's a kind of discombobulating, and you try not to think about it, but then you can't help but notice their physical similarities. And it to the extent they were able, they're such good, capable actors. Apologies, I can't remember what her daughter's name is. But this show, Maid, it was also set in the Pacific Northwest and features a young mom who resorts to cleaning the houses of rich folk in the Seattle area when her marriage goes south. And that's the only other example I can really think off the top of my dome here about mother and daughter dynamics like this. And I think when you approach a film like Hellbender, you're going to come with your set of biases and perceptions. And I'll be honest up front, witchly genres and witch type films and folk horror is not maybe my go-to when I'm looking for something to watch. And it's not like I don't have some sort of affinity for it, both culturally and historically. I mean, actually, as an aside, I made my acting debut. This is, you know, pretty pathetic, but I was in a high school production of Arthur Miller's The Crucible. And since I couldn't act, they just made me a judge. And I just basically yelled at people saying, like, I saw Sarah Goody with the devil. I saw Abigail Johnson with the devil. And I had maybe 3 to 4 lines, so I didn't have to exactly equip myself in this solo one-man show type thing. It was in a very ensemble, and I did with it what I could. I was terrified, and I just mostly helped with the set design. But I think the history in the case of witches is much more compelling than how it's actually manifest in film. And that's with a few exceptions. I mean, obviously, when you're looking at some of the Italian productions in Suspiria, which is really the apotheosis of any kind of witchly horror, that's the kind of thing I can really sink my teeth into. And that shares some visual appeal elements. And I think some have accused Argento of not really plotting his movies particularly inventively either. But when you have, like, again, lots of visual appeal can carry the day. And in this film, Izzy, the Zelda Adams character, the daughter, she's a drummer, and she ventures out of the woods and a little beyond, I guess, the her circumscribed location in the middle of the woods, and comes upon a neighbor who's basically squatting and using a rich person's pool and just lying there by the side of the pool, drinking Beck's, and looking alluring in a white bikini. And basically, she's just there to waves to this interloper nymph-like newcomer, and the two of them hit it off, and have some beers and go swimming and continue to squat at this neighbor's pool. And it's very, very charming how the two of them hit it off, and they engage in a tequila-based drinking game. And she introduces her, this Izzy, into a wider circle of friends that she gradually comes to connect with, and causes a schism between her and her mother. And she discloses to her newfound friends that she's got this autoimmune deficiency, and it's linked to this maternal bloodline and genes. And without spoiling anything, you have this backstory between the two of them, and spells and witches and whatnot. It's almost like mixing up a potion, like it's Macbeth or something. But yeah, so again, I can come here to both praise and to bury this film, but I'm trying to keep an open mind as always. It's just, you can't help but look askance at a 97% Rotten Tomatoes film and just wonder maybe how this might have come about if it wasn't just some sort of masturbation exercise on the part of critics. Because it's, I always, or tried as best to argue that for the most part, art is objective and not subjective. There are commonalities to things that have lasting cultural and intellectual appeal that can't be denied. And you'd be a fool, I think, to make an aesthetic claim that Tommy Wiseau's The Room is superior to Goodfellas or The Godfather or something, even though they're quite disparate films and whatnot. And just, and nothing, irks me like someone saying, oh, I enjoyed it more. Well, I mean, I can jerk off and enjoy that more than I can the ballet, but that doesn't mean, my enjoyment of something can extrapolate to something broader that has a more profound, deeper, and more wide ranging and appeal than that. Simply, oh, I liked it. I mean, there has to be some reason, and you can't compare King Lear with Hard to Kill or some reactionary 90s action movie in terms of what you can read into it and what one more broadly brings to the cultural to culture writ large. I mean, it's absurd nonsense. I just absolutely can't stand that just because you enjoy the music of Billie Eilish or whatever, that somehow her musical output is going to rival that of Igor Stravinsky. I mean, it's just so ridiculous on so many levels. I mean, you can enjoy things to a different extents, but there ultimately has to be some sort of standard in art and some sort of benchmark that you can relate everything to. And regarding this one, I mean, Jeff and I, when we started the Really Awful Movies site and associated podcast, we were frequently championing indie films and would frequently solicit films for and review copies there to put on our site or to talk about and whatnot. And it's something we've not done for several years, just because of time constraints and whatnot. But we couldn't help but I think over praise films that were under budget, if you want to coin a phrase, I guess. There was something like, you can't help but give credit. It's almost like Ukraine's capabilities against Russia, right? I mean, to the extent that they're performing better than anyone thought, and we're approaching month two of that ugly conflict and that steely-eyed KGB thug Putin and his designs he has on a sovereign nation. But like, you know, you have this plucky country with 40 million people defending itself against this erstwhile supposed global superpower, and you can tend to fall into the trap that that they're performing like extra good just because they really don't have the resources. And they're doing splendidly. But when you have a film that has maybe 50K put against it, you treat it differently, and you can't sort of separate yourself from something that has $80 million behind it and is some big budget franchise effort that is going global. So you take it with a grain of salt, and you try and suss out to the best you can things that that are unique to it. And I think I'm fair in my assessment of this one. And there's something to it, and it really does get going. Although I think also the tequila and worm scene was wildly overhyped as well. There are certain elements of tameness to this that I didn't really expect to be the case given, but I think that also correlates broadly with films that transcend the horror space and become more widely accepted and or reviewed by the broader public, the MSM, right? The mainstream media that tends to look down on horror as something that's not worthy of critical interrogation, which is frequently the opposite. I mean, the subtext you get from a horror film, they're frequently way more interesting than a lot of, well, certainly action movies that wherein subtext is almost frequently non-existent. But so, you know, they descended from their ivory towers to look into this one and take that, take note of that, because there are only certain types of films that the likes of The Guardian deem worthy enough to engage with. And you should take note of that, because when we are looking for at other films that maybe really hit hard and punch above their weight on the indie side of things too, like Terrifier, which has brought us in Art the Clown, I think one of the iconic horror antagonists, even despite it being a relatively new film. But that one obviously is not going to get written up in The Atlantic or anything. So let's be real. There is a certain type of supernatural horror that seems to make its way into coverage in a way that other movies resolutely don't, different subgenres of horror. And so take that with a grain of salt. And I'm going to deviate slightly from format here, and I guess I can mention a few things I learned. But again, the band is terrific. And I'm thinking of like New Year's Evil. It's another movie with really good music in the background as a horror film, and the way they engage with one another and the way they play is fantastic, and their music's kind of fun. It is really good, and they're really a garage band that doesn't play for anyone, and that's a sticking point for the daughter when she says, you know what, we actually are really good and we should play for people, and the mother kiboshes it immediately. So there's Lots of charm to be spread around in this one for sure, and lots of like cheeky little fun moments. And again, the Izzy character is just Zelda Adams just drives this one forward with a kind of Candidian sort of innocence to her face, and she just has not really a blank look, like she's very spirited, but she really pulls off that naivete that the role really demands, and the mother being the controlling mother. It's terrific dynamics, but it can only take you so far. Again, it really depends what mood you're in. I've alluded to the Julie Delpy, Ethan Hawke film several occasions, the Sunrise trilogy, like Before Sunrise and that, where it just basically has two people talking for a large part of it. Although that one has enough character development that it really keeps you going, at least in my case. Like maybe it's a symptom or sign of age, but I just find stuff where movies where things don't happen to really push my buttons, and something has to, from a narrative standpoint, keep things of interest. I almost want to quote that oft-quoted Chekhov line about the gun appearing in one scene and has to be fired within a certain, I forget, it's oft-quoted, but you have to have something propelling it forward. Otherwise, it's just like little vignettes. And little vignettes are great. I mean, this is a beautifully lensed film for on a budget with some really keen, really very, very curious and interesting visual stimulation, and a lot of interesting little scenes between mother and daughter that are just very warm and confined. And this is a fairly intriguing movie from beginning to end, but there's some sagging, and there's some it almost seems like a short film that they try to extend to full-length runtime. I had a similar reaction to Titan, which in retrospect seems almost like, you know, Raid Redemption or like the Old Boy in terms of action compared with this one. But that's no slight. I'm going to give this, I think, 3 out of 5, which is fair. I think, again, depending on your proclivities and inclinations toward art house, with a capital A, cinema, or whether you need to have something more conventional plot-wise to hold your interest, that'll dictate whether you add or subtract a star. Anyway, good to be back, and help the show out, if you could, by picking up a copy of Mine's Bigger Than Yours, the 100 Wackiest Action Movies. Just got a royalty statement from our publisher, so the book's doing quite well. We're hoping it can do a little bit better, so came out in November of 2020, but it's still new, and if you're an action genre film like fan of Greg Daniels, the Kickboxer, Jean-Claude Van Damme, or you know, some of the lesser-known efforts of Seagal, you'll really get a kick out of that one. And of course, our first book, Death by Umbrella, foreword by Lloyd Kaufman from Troma. You'll like that if you're a horror head, dyed in the wool like Jeff and I. Anyway, we'll talk to you soon, and take care. Thank you.